Our topic for discussion and thoughts this afternoon is entitled The Fall of Babylon, with a caveat, from a student of Revelation. You know, whenever we talk about Revelation and prophecy, we have to do it with a degree of trepidation because, of course, we can't say with surety too much of anything that is yet future. And we see many of these prophecies being revealed. And so we're going to present this in the attitude of presenting our thoughts on the subject and give you our reasoning. And hopefully it will be a topic that will cause discussion at the dinner table and in our further fellowship. And that's the spirit in which it's given. There are a number of keys to unlocking the key to Babylon's downfall. And the keys to its understanding, first is we need to look at the events of literal Babylon's fall. Because in doing so, you know, it was put out there as an example. So when we see it illustrated in Revelation, we should go back and look at the place where it's stated in prophecy and see what we can glean there, because the Old and New Testament complement each other and support each other as well. So we're going to look at some of the events of Babylon's fall. And to start with, as good Bible students, of course, we would look at the meaning of the word Babylon. And Babel itself means confusion. You know, you can think about it as a small child. You know, they're described as babbling. You know, we have a grandson that's not quite two, and he's to the babbling stage. So he has a language and he speaks, but nobody pretty much understands him yet. We're working on that. And really that's kind of typical of Babylon as well, because it represents a confused system. Now, up on the screen, you see an example or an illustration of one artist's rendering of the Tower of Babel. And the tower was built with a purpose, and that was to glorify men. And so you see it was quite contrary to God's will. When we look at Babylon in Hebrew, it means confusion, but in Assyrian, it means the gate of God. And so you can see here when they built the Tower of Babel, they said, basically, it was to glorify men, but it was to put them on par with God. And that's why it was such really an abomination to him. And that's the thing that we want to focus in on here as well. And we believe that Babylon, in the most focused sense, represents the papal system, but really all the false church systems as well, the daughter systems as well. When we look at Babylon in the Bible, it's kind of interesting. It was a city. You know, if you go to your Bible map, there's a city called Babylon. It was the capital of a country, but it also represented an empire. So it had four different aspects to it. And in the scriptures, it is known by the names of Babylon, Babylonia, Chaldea, and Shinar. So, you know, when we see references to Chaldea and Shinar, we're talking about the same area. And it's interesting when we look at, if we equate it to the papal system is exactly the same. The Vatican is a city. The Vatican is a worldwide capital for that system. It's actually a country. It's recognized by nations around the world and as a country, but it's also an empire. And we're seeing here, as we look to the Old Testament, to the characteristics of Babylon, we see that they line up very nicely with the papal system. Now, here's an illustration of what they think Babylon's brick walls look like. And to give you some concept, it was 300 feet tall and about 75 feet thick. These are formidable walls. When you came up to him, here's a 25-story building, which is approximately 300 feet tall. And you get a reference when you walked up to that, and that was a wall of a city of tremendous dimensions, and you could walk the circumference of it. It was formidable. It's also interesting to note that this was brick walls, but this was not fired brick, but it was mud brick. And they were made of clay and mud and not stone. And that was a little bit unusual, but if you look at the region, the valley where it is, there's really not a lot of stones to build with. And so that's the reason that Babylon's walls were, from a building standpoint, weak. And we think this is symbolic as well. Now, there was a number of steps in Babylon's fall. And I know what you're thinking, because really before I studied this out, I said, okay, it's pretty easy. They diverted the river and they went under the water gate. That was step one. The waters dried up. We find that in Jeremiah 51:36. But there was actually two more steps. Number two was the gates to the temple area were unguarded. So they came down the riverbed, then they came out of the river and they went on a bridge across, but there were actually gates into the city at that point. And because of a celebration, those gates were unguarded. The guards were drunk. And so they were able to go right in without resistance. And then number three, the people were slain. So the people were slain and the city was spoiled. And that's in Jeremiah 51:40. So we see, as we refer to the Old Testament, we have to look at the events that took place. And then we're going to look at the Revelation picture to see how that relates to the fall of Babylon as well. And so the bottom line here is that we can find references to the fall of Babylon, literal Babylon, in Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51 that'll give us keen insights into what happens with Revelation. The bottom line, though, is after the spoiling of that city, this is a picture of one section of that that's been dug up and excavated, basically nothing grows there anymore, which is also very symbolic, we believe. Now, this is a map of the city of Babylon, and we're all familiar with the river gate that's at the top, and that's where they diverted the river. It dried up, so they had these massive bronze gates that couldn't be penetrated, but if you dry the river up, you can walk right under them. So that's how they entered in. They proceeded down the dried up riverbed to the bridge at the temple gate, where they exited, crossed the bridge, and as I said, the temple gate was left unguarded because nobody could get into the city, and they were having this drunken party, and so the gates were left wide open. And then they went into the temple, indicated by really the temple gate arrow. If you continue, you see the temple is right there, and that's where that was spoiled. Now, this was a very, very large city as well. There's the temple gate illustrated, and then you see the temple. So we see that Babylon was really a fortress city. It was really considered impenetrable, and that was a key part of that empire of Babylon. It was considered very formidable, and yet we realize that it was largely appearances. Because when you build with mud and clay, what happens in the rain, what happens, it crumbles, and so forth. Next, let's look at some scriptures specifically talking about Babylon. And I think this will help us clarify what is going to happen with Babylon and what we're in the process of happening. And if we wanted to look at scriptures, we would look in 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Psalms, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Micah, Zechariah, Matthew, Acts, 1 Peter, and Revelation. That's a long list. There's quite a bit in the scriptures about Babylon. And, you know, as students of Revelation, we don't just want to look at Revelation. We want to look at these other places because they will give us additional insights into the fall of Babylon as well. And so we look at, I've kind of condensed them all down. These are cliff notes for you to help you. So when we look at the confounding of Babylon, we find that in Jeremiah 50. We have a description of Babylon being emptied and desolate, and we find that in Jeremiah 50 and 51, basically. We have a description of that they've sinned against God. That's found in Jeremiah 50 also. We're told to come out of her. And, you know, we think about this as I always think about this as a revelation type of command, but in fact it's found in Jeremiah 50 and 51, Isaiah, and also in 2 Corinthians. The wrath of God destroys her, and that description is given to us in Jeremiah 50 and 51. The drought upon the waters is found in Jeremiah 50 and 51. Being drunken with wine, and this is really where we get that description of those those temple gates being totally unguarded. They're open. And you can just walk right in. And that's what the invading force did. The fall of Babylon is both in Jeremiah 51 and Isaiah. The breaking down process in Jeremiah. The burning with fire in Jeremiah. The threshing floor illustration is given to us both in Jeremiah 51 and Isaiah 21. And finally, the millstone is talked about in Jeremiah 51. So, as Bible students, we would look these up, we would get the background, we would read, and this would give us a pretty good idea of what happened to literal Babylon and also what was prophesied against the religious Babylon. Now we add in the Revelation scriptures, because you notice there wasn't any revelation there. But you'll notice in the Revelation scriptures, in green, that there are corresponding entries in Revelation. So if we want to understand the confounding in Revelation 18:10, we should really look at Jeremiah 50 verse 2 and verse 12. And this can give us some very keen insights. So this is what we've done in our study, and we will share with you today for your consideration. So we have the third part, which is really framing the Revelation visions with the scriptures that we find in the Old and New Testament. Now, the keys to Revelation are given to us right in the beginning, and I appreciate the New Albany Bible students. They have a book on Revelation that really gave us these insights into how to decipher the visions, plural, in Revelation. And it really starts out with Revelation 1, 1 and 2. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. So this is prophetic, and it's telling you that right there. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto servant John, who bare record of the word and of the testimony of Jesus Christ and of all things that he saw. So Revelation, in its the meaning of the word, is a revealing. And so as we look to Revelation, it should reveal to us some of the things that are to come to pass. Now, there are two things that are key here. In Revelation 1:1, it says, to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. So this is saying, this is a key. Who are his servants? The servant class. And so he's saying, I'm going to reveal these unto you, and you should have some understanding of these as well. So that's one key word. He's talking about things, plural, so it's going to talk about processes and events. And he says they're going to come to pass. These are things yet future. And so his audience really is this servant class, and that's very important. So when we go to and talk to someone in the world about Revelation, even if they're well studied in the Bible, it's no surprise that there is confusion. Because he says, who's going to be the ones that he's going to show this to and will understand? It's the servant class. And so right here, it's self-contained. He's telling you this is how it's going to work, which is to say the non-servant class is not going to understand this. They're going to be in what? Confusion. And that's really the state that we find. Now, there's a key here. There's two keys, actually, here. And it's interesting that Revelation is a book of keys, and they give you the keys in the first two verses. And the keys are these two words, to show and he saw. And those two words in the Greek mean to show, to see, or to know. And so what he's defining here is he says, I'm going to give you a process, and I'm going to demark it with these words. And this is the key. And it's kind of like you see these rocks here. These are things called cairns. And these are things that if you go hiking in a very rough area, like a volcanic area or a rocky area, you use cairns to figure out where the trail is. Because you look at this and it's like, where's the trail? I can't tell. But what you do when you're hiking these is you establish one and you look and find the next. And then you find the next. And then you find the next. And this is the exact way that Revelation is laid out. And so what he's saying is, I'm going to give you a vision, and it's going to go from here to here. And then we're going to rewind. How are we going to rewind? Well, it could be forward, it could be backward. It could be the same thing repeated over again, but from a different perspective. And so these I saws and to show are the keys. Now, because we have concordances, we can actually go and we're going to show you the map of Revelation, and it lays out these visions very neatly. And as such, it lets us know where the start of one is and the end of the next is. So you have very clearly defined the different visions. So this is key. And we think it's very important. Look at it. He says it's going to be a book of revealment, and then he gives you the keys right there. And then when you apply those keys, now you can see the visions. And who's going to see the visions? The servant class. So I don't know about you, but I find this very exciting. In Revelation 1:3, the verse right after this, so he gives us the keys in 1 and 2. And then in 3 he says, "Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things that are written therein, for the time is at hand." So he's saying here, you're going to be blessed. And not only are you going to be blessed because you're going to see it and hear it, but then you're going to do something. You're going to keep something. So now he's given a responsibility here. So it's not just a matter of this is an interesting intellectual study. He's saying that the keys of Revelation are going to be revealed unto you, and then there's something that you need to do. But you're not going to understand it until you unlock the keys to this book. So this should motivate us. So we read, we hear, and then we keep. So after he gives us the keys, now he says, here's your responsibilities. Read, hear, and keep. This should be kind of intriguing to us at the very least. So an understanding of the visions of Revelation should provoke us onto actions. What are those actions? Let's look at what's in the book. If we were to do an overview of Revelation, there are a number of sections. We can section this off. Revelation 1, 1 through 8 really is an introduction. So he gives us an introduction. He tells us who it's for. He tells you you're going to understand it. He gives you the keys. Now he says you have actionable information that you need to do. And then he starts us out in Revelation 1, 9 through 14, 5. It's all about the gospel age. In Revelation 14, 6 through 19, 21, it's visions of the harvest, that last period of the gospel age. And then finally, in Revelation 20, verse 1, through the end, it's revealing on the millennium, or the messianic age. And so we see very clearly here, wow, this. So now we've nicely sectioned off the book. Now, when you do this, now if you're reading in Revelation 7, what period are you talking about? Well, the gospel age is a greater period. If you're reading in Revelation 16, well, you're reading about the harvest of the gospel age. And if you're, of course, in Revelation 20 or 21, then you're talking about the messianic age of the millennium. So let's look at these visions. And here the visions are actually laid out. So if you have this map, you basically have the keys to each separate vision in Revelation. Now, one of the things you should note as you look at this is they don't necessarily end exactly on chapter lines, okay, which is very key. And we'll delve into a little bit of that as well. So we want to look at them and see what time periods they span. And once again, this is done by using these markers that said, I saw or to show. I show. So we can look in the concordance, we can see where they start and end, and now we can try to make sense and decipher the vision. When we look at, and we're going to focus in, because we're dealing with Babylon, we're going to focus in on the harvest period. And we actually have five different versions. There's five different visions there in the harvest. One on harvest works, one's historical, one's political, one's economic, and one's spiritual. What do I mean? I'll show you how they map. Once again, now we're drilling down. We're doing a little bit more detail of what's happening. So first we have a vision of harvest works, then historical, then political, economic. And they, within a vision, they're sequential. But between visions, they can start and stop at different times. That's the importance of the endpoints, because if you assume they all start at the same time and they all end at the same time, the different visions, then you're going to be a little confused as to the events. So there are five different perspectives of the harvest shown in Revelation. Let's look at these visions. Now we're drilling down and we're seeing that the harvest works are shown in Revelation 14, 6 through 20. Next, the historical, Revelation 15, 1 through Revelation 16, 21. Revelation 17, 1 through 18, the political, Revelation 18, 19 through 19, 10. Doesn't break on a chapter. That's the economic. And then we go Revelation 19, 11 through 21, spiritual. Let's look at the characteristics. Once again, these start with I saw or to show, those same Greek words. The visions don't always break nicely on chapters. They're sequential within a vision. The visions don't all start or end at the same time. So from a historical perspective, maybe it starts a little later or ends a little earlier than subsequent visions. So you've got to be aware of that. And the visions don't always detail the same events. It's kind of like the Gospels. You know, the Gospels are different perspectives of different apostles, and they leave some things out and other things in. And if you think about it, if I'm going to give you a historical perspective, well, that's going to be historical. If I give you political, that may be quite a bit different because it's a different perspective. And so we have different perspective of each event. And what's important is if we're confused about what's being said there, we can go back to the Old and New Testament, to those references of Babylon, and look up the events that we're reading about. For instance, the casting of the millstone. There are other scriptures that talk about that. And so reading those, we can get an understanding of the context. Now, when it comes to the fall of Babylon, some brethren say everything's past. Some say it's happening now. Some say it's everything's future. And we probably have a mix in between as well. And so once again, we're presenting our thoughts on the subject, not in a dogmatic way, but to really stimulate all of our thoughts and to prove all things. You know, some of the best talks I hear, I don't agree with at all. But they're good talks because they cause me to go back and restudy and reprove things in my own mind, or perhaps question things that I had assumed. So each of these, regardless, describe a process. When we look at the harvest visions, we have a harvesting angel, a condemning angel, a warning angel, the Lord of the harvest, the great multitude, the glorified church, and then our Babylon event, the winepress destroys Babylon. Once again, these are sequential within a vision. Number two, the political vision found in Revelation 17. We have a number of events. This time, a judgment of Babylon, the history of Babylon's glory, mystic Babylon, the decline of Babylon. It was a very political system, remember? Literally, it was. The war on the Lamb, the burning of Babylon, and then the agency of Babylon's destruction. So you notice in the historical one, we had one event at the end on Babylon, and the political is preoccupied with Babylon. When we look at the economic, Babylon's doomed, she's going to be paid back, so on and so forth. We see other things, and then finally we see a total collapse of Babylon, and then rejoicing at her destruction at the very end. Now, is Revelation 14:8 past, present, or future? When we read Revelation 14, 3 through 5, and they sung as it were a new song before the throne, these were the redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto the Lamb, unto God and the Lamb. They are without fault, they are before the throne. That's a throne scene. That's yet future. We agree on that. Now, the key here is we do a rewind, because right here in Revelation 14, 6, we have a new I saw. Now, a lot of brethren will read this through and then they say, well, this proves that, you know, they read through and say, now this is part of this other vision. But it's important that we differentiate. So now we saw another angel fly out. And what did he say? Down in the bottom, and there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of her wrath, of her fornication. So we have two fallens here. He says it twice. He repeats it. That's an emphasis. Is it past, present, or future? We continue. And then we talk about a third angel. And then at the very bottom here in Revelation 14:13, it says, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. So it's really talking about the sleeping saints, and that's farther on in the vision. So you're saying, okay, well, it talks about fallen, doesn't that mean they're gone already? Let's look at that just a little more. There are three angels here. The first angel in Revelation preaches the harvest message. The second angel condemns Babylon. And the third angel warns to come out of her. So this is right in the front. Is there any correspondence to events that have already happened? We'll suggest. In 1874, that harvest message went out. And remember what happened in Babylon? Once they went under the water gate, they just walked right into the temple because the gates were unguarded. And when we look at the truth going out from 1874 on, that harvest message went out with very little resistance. In fact, we get more resistance today from churches than they did in that day. And then it says it is fallen. That's twice, and that's important. So their condemnation is really framed by scriptures, by these warnings. And that's when we were told to come out of those systems, because you're not going to find truth there. You're not going to be edified there. In fact, it will be against the truth. In Revelation, if we turn back to Revelation 8, you'll notice that there are a bunch of threes. In Revelation 8, 7 through 11, it talks about a third part, what happened? Burn up. A third part, what happened? Died. A third part, what happened? The waters dried up. Complete destruction. In Revelation 8:12, we have three more third parts. They were smitten, they were blackened, and they were darkened. Gone. Threes, a complete picture. In Revelation 8:13, a woe. Three repeats again. And so we're suggesting that in Revelation, when we look at threes, that means complete destruction. Revelation 9:18, these three things. They were killed, fire, smoke, and brimstone. And so this means complete destruction. So what happens? Babylon is fallen. Is it gone? And that's the real question. Consider the possibility. Number one fallen. In 1799, the Pope died in captivity. That's when the water dried up, and that's really when the doctrine that he was God on earth really kind of became a fallacy aware to everyone. Because all of a sudden, you know, if he's God's representative on earth, how can this Napoleon take him, he dies in captivity, and stop God from putting another representative on earth? It showed the fallacy of the system, and it's known as the low point in the papal system. And what about if in 1874... the harvest message went out and the gates were left unlocked and the word went out largely unnoticed until it had infiltrated? I mean, today we don't really have a concept of how widespread and popular and how well published the pastor really was, and the truth went out. We think fallen number three, remember said three in Revelation, threes represent complete destruction. We think that is yet future. A financial downfall. They'll be empty. They'll be desolate. They'll be stripped of their wealth. And the false system will go down for how long? Forever. Never to be heard of again. So what's happening to Babylon? Is Babylon still around? We'll ask three questions. Are the people gone? Have they lost their great wealth? And is the papal system gone forever? Never to be seen again. It's gone. Are there people still in Babylon? Well, yes, there are. If we look at these numbers, we see that there are millions, hundreds of millions, still in the papal system. This is the Roman Catholic Church, not including the Protestant churches. So today there are over 1 billion Catholics. Now, are they nominal? Yeah, many of them are nominal. Okay, but they're still Catholics. They still identify themselves as Catholics. What about the wealth of Babylon? There's been a lot of scandals. I remember a number of years ago, the Boston Archdiocese was going to go bankrupt until they found out that the settlement that they had done took about one-tenth of their wealth. Okay? So they literally have billions in assets because people do things like bequeaths. They own banks, they own stocks, they own gold, they own land. Their businesses are tax exempt, and therefore they're not on the books. And so you don't even know the value of some of their assets. So yes, there have been scandals. Down but not out is how I would put it. Yeah, they've been bloodied, but they're still out there. There's a book called The Vatican Billions. And according to this author, the Catholic Church is the greatest possessor of material riches of any other single institution, corporation, bank, giant trust, government, or state in the whole globe. They're rich. Now, it may be now that some of the Arab states with the transfer of wealth are richer, but in any case, they're a significantly wealthy thing. Now, they are cash poor at this moment, because their contributions are not great, but they have holdings in hospitals, in land, in churches, in daycare. They have lots of businesses they're in. And as I said, in most countries, they're not on the books. Babylon in today's world. What about leadership? Well, we have a new pope. He claims he's the vicar of Jesus. They are a sovereign state according to the United Nations in all countries. They have their own Vatican euro. I wanted to get one of these just to have one. They have a Vatican euro. So they got their own money. And their outreach has been extensive. This is just 2005 and 6, but really he's traveling the entire world. So are the people gone? No. Is their wealth gone? No. Has the papal system gone away forever? Not yet. It's building, but it's not yet there. Pastor Russell in 1914 said, talking about the great company of the Lord's people are left here. Many of these will apparently continue into Babylon until the time of trouble shall cause Babylon to fall. That was his view in 1914. Continuing on, what he says again in June of 1914 is, we believe that these prophecies are to be fulfilled in what? In the very near future. So he thought it was right at the door, but he was saying, not yet. Not yet, even though he's halfway through 1914. So he's saying, this separating work's not yet complete, and therefore Babylon can't be off the scene quite yet. So the harvest goes grandly on. That's how he left it. Now, is there actionable information within Revelation? Babylon has fallen, showing their decline, and we all would not contest that. We're told to come out of her, or we'll receive of her plagues. We're told that the church will be gone before her downfall, and that some of the persecution on the great company will be based on Babylon. So those events, we believe, would be still future. And we're told that blood comes out of her, out of the winepress when she dies. What's the lifeblood of any organization on this earth today? It's money. They still have money. So they haven't been drained yet. But we see things right on the horizon. And the millstone, like a millstone, if I tie a millstone on you and cast you into a pond, we're not going to see you again. You're gone. That's yet future. Blessed are your eyes so you see these things. But we should be watching and waiting and watching these things. What does it say in Revelation 1:3? Here's what we're supposed to do. Blessed are they that read, that hear, and that keep these words. So we should be students of Revelation. It's very important. We appreciate God's marvelous plan and his revealing of these things unto us. For from him and to him and through him are all things. To God be the glory forever. Amen.